A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rehm, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on June 8, 1997, entitled Love Enfleshed. The texts for the sermon are Hosea 11, verses 1 through 9, 1 John 4, verse 16, and Luke 10, verses 25 through 37. Copyright Grand Valley State University.
Those of you that have been around a while with me know that I like to preach in series. It helps to focus my own thinking and reading and reflection, and it keeps you in a rut. But there are those periods of time when I don't have a series and I just sort of spot things in, and then sometimes I find I'm in an accidental series, and that's where I am right now. I'm fascinated with God. And I think that happened as I began to reflect on Pentecost and thinking about the Spirit of God. Thinking about the Spirit of God in terms of the cosmos that we are all a part of. The fact that the Spirit of God is the breath of God. That breath of God that hovered over the chaos of creation's dawn. Maybe 15 billion years ago, that Spirit or breath of God that permeates the whole of reality, shot through with the breath of God, the wind of God, enlivening all that is, nothing existing apart from that inspiring, in-breathing of God's Spirit. So that the birth of the church, the Jesus movement that emerged into the Christian church, which we celebrate on Pentecost, is really not something new. It's simply another stage, another development. It is simply the in continuity with that which has been true throughout all, the enlivening, permeating presence of God's breath, God's Spirit. And then we come to Trinity Sunday, and we recognize that God is a mystery beyond our fathoming. The old theologians spoke about the incomprehensibility of God, that we cannot know God. And on Pentecost, yet we experience that mystery as an ever-present, enlivening wind or breath. And so we have a mystery, and we have that permeating, life-giving power force. But how do we give some focus to it? And then we discover a face. And in the face of Jesus, we believe we see into the heart of God. So that that mystery beyond our fathoming takes on some definition. The nature of that ministry, of that mystery becomes concrete. In that human form of Jesus, who shows us the way, and the way to be in communion with that mystery that we cannot touch nor grasp. And so we have a face and an enlivening breath throughout all, lifting us to a mystery beyond us. And yet, we are meaning-seeking animals. And that may be all well and good, but what does it mean for my life? Those deep questions. Because as we have noted, the deep questions about God are really deep questions about ourselves. Whence have we come? Whither are we going? And what is the meaning of it in the meantime? What does it mean for my concrete living today in the concrete context of my life? This mystery that is God, that is focused in a face and experienced as life. Well, I think it just goes to show that there's something deep within us that wants to know, that needs to know about the meaning of it all. The current issue of Life magazine has in bold print why we are looking for the meaning of our soul in the stars, and then in bolder print, the rising of astrology. And there is a rather main theme article in that picture magazine about current stargazing. And we are told there that there is more interest in astrology today than in the past 400 years. The last period of time when there was a lot of interest in the stargazing, palm reading, finding the alignment of the planets was during the period of the Renaissance. And today, at this post-Enlightenment era, when we have moved through all of the scientific discoveries and the scientific method and all of the rationality of the Enlightenment, we have a world that is more interested in stargazing than in the past 400 years. Well, that art goes back over 3,000 years to Babylon, and it's been with us ever since. Some periods rather lean, some periods of popularity, as at present. But it's amazing to me. Here, people all over the globe are asking to have their destiny read out from the heavenly planets. And we can scoff at it and laugh at it, and yet there's a rather fascinating tie-in with astrology and the concepts of modern physics. One of Einstein's protégés, David Bohm, an English physicist and no mean scientist, has been very interested in the connection between the two. He speaks about reality, cosmic reality, as an unbroken entity in flow. And he speaks about matter and energy and meaning as the three manifestations of this unbroken flow of reality. And then he suggests that maybe there is that constant tug to check the stars, because after all, we are star children, we are stardust. And he speaks of an implicant order of reality. He uses an analogy. If you take two cylinders, let's say they're glass, two cylinders, one fitting in the other, with just a little space between them, fill that with some high viscosity liquid, some heavy oil perhaps, and then into the oil drop a drop of ink. Now you can see in this, through the cylinder walls, you see that drop of ink. Now you spin the cylinders in opposite directions. What happens to the drop of ink? Well, it begins to make a circle around that cylinder. And if you continue to spin at a high rate of speed, eventually that line becomes thinner and thinner and thinner until it disappears and is actually absorbed into that liquid. You can no longer identify that spot of ink that once was so clear. Now what happens if you reverse the cylinders in the other direction? Will you gather it again until finally it becomes that point from which you began? And so he says there is an implicant order of reality in which every spot of ink, everything is connected with everything else. But he says that implicate order is beyond our fathoming. There is an explicate order that our senses can observe, and it's like observing the tip of the iceberg. With our senses, we have accessible to us the tip of the iceberg of reality. The rest is mystery, but it is one totality, one continuity, and it's manifested in energy and matter and meaning. And so, the human person is an animal that asks deep questions. But when we do that, it's not just an intellectual exercise. It's not an academic game. We're not playing with riddles for fun. We're asking the deep questions of our lives. What then does it mean to be alive, to be conscious, to be aware? What does it mean to be in relationship? What does it mean to be in community? What does it mean to be this human person caught up in this totality of reality? What does it mean for my life? And those are the questions that the Bible addresses. The Bible's not a book of theology. The Bible is not about theological questions about who can be saved and where heaven is and a multitude of other things that preachers talk about every Sunday. That's not what the Bible is. The Bible is a whole cumulative set of stories of concrete encounter with God. Because that's really what we want. We want to experience God. Knowledge is fine, but it's experience for which we hunger. And the Bible tells us about people. People who have shaped us in our tradition, who have had an experience of God and tell the story. And in telling the story, they draw us into the story and prepare us to experience similarly in our own stories. And at the heart of the biblical conviction is that confidence that God is love. Now, the title of the message in the liturgy is Love in Flesh. But I really didn't mean to put love in flesh. I really meant to put mystery in flesh. That's the way it appeared in the newspaper ads, and that's correct, because what I want to say is the mystery that we cannot touch, we cannot fathom, the mystery in flesh can be experienced. But as a matter of fact, if John is right, who says God is love, then it amounts to the same thing. My point to you this morning is simply this. To experience love is to experience God. Mystery in flesh, love in flesh, is the experience of God. Hosea, the Hebrew prophet, has no equal when it comes to talking about the passionate love of God. The first three chapters of his prophecy, which were not read this morning, are about Hosea's own personal experience with an unfaithful wife who he has to bring back out of her unfaithfulness to a loving relationship again. And then out of his own personal experience, he experiences the anguish of the heart of God over a people that God has loved, but a people who turn their back on God. And so Hosea speaks of the marriage relationship as an image of the relationship of God and God's people. But in the passage that was read, the image is that of a parent and a child. When Israel was a child, I brought him out of Egypt. I picked him up. I held him in my arms. I brought him to my cheek. The intimate, beautiful image of a parent and a child, that deep, binding, bonding love. That is the image that Hosea has for the relationship of God to God's people. And the child turns away, and the child deserves to be cut off. And then in the midst of that statement of the child's unfaithfulness, we hear these words, "But how can I give you up, O Ephraim? My heart warms within me. My compassion roils within me. I cannot give you up. I will not give you up because I am God, not human." It would be human. It would be expected. It would be normal and natural to have you cut off. But I am not human. I am God. I am love. I am passionate love. I will not let you go. And of course, this is what John was talking about when he said God is love. But again, John wasn't talking about some speculative theological proposition that appears in a creed. John was talking about concrete human experience. For he says, God is love. And the one who dwells in love dwells in God. He says, the one who dwells in love, God abides in that one, and that one abides in God. And he says, if someone should say, oh, I love God, but doesn't love his brother or sister, that one is simply a liar. That one is not speaking truth. Where John says, you cannot love God whom you have not seen if you do not love the flesh around you, humankind that crosses your path. And, of course, Jesus, the supreme storyteller. I hate to say this with my son here, but in Jesus' day also there were lawyers. Lawyers who would put him to the test. So Luke tells us. And so the lawyer says, what must I do to inherit eternal life? But Jesus is equal to the lawyer. He says, well, what does it say in the Torah? Well, love the Lord your God with heart, soul, mind, and strength, and your neighbor as yourself. Jesus said, right answer, go do it. But lawyers. He begins to think about all of his neighbors and of the exhausting imperative. And so he would carve out a little more manageable space for himself. And so he says, well, could you define neighbor? And Jesus tells the story of the Good Samaritan. The religious people on their way to General Synod who didn't have time. I mean, and then the outcast Samaritan who met the need of the person. And then, of course, Jesus won't answer it. He makes the lawyer answer his own question. Who do you think? Now, this is good. The lawyer says, who's my neighbor? Jesus says, who was neighbor to the one in need? Nice twist, isn't it? I'm not going to go out there and tell you, the people, who you ought to care for. I'm telling you that you are the person to care for any human need that crosses your path. It is in doing love that God is experienced. It is in the practice of the faith that the reality of God is known. It is in the action of love that the academic questions disappear and the reality of concrete human experience. As I was reflecting on this last evening, my contemplation was broken by a call from below. It was Nancy. She is the sports fan in the family. She said, would you like to see history for a moment? Knowing that her husband is sick, she's very patient with me, but she did call me down with a minute 40 left, and I was going to say, after that experience, the discovery of God, the experience of God, is winning the Stanley Cup. I really did think about it. I didn't admit this to her, but I really was thinking about the sermon. When I saw those thousands of people made as one, in communion, in community, in a moment of exhilaration, of pure joy, I saw them transcended out of themselves, pulled out of themselves. They didn't think about any problem they had, any ache or pain or anything that was going on in their lives. For a moment, they were transported, they were transcended into one rejoicing, jubilant community. And I thought to myself, maybe the temples of the 21st century are the great sports palaces that now punctuate this land. And maybe it is in the sports arena that God will be found in the future. Guy, you laugh, but I'm serious. I'm serious. But then I thought, the Red Wings, let alone the Flyers, after that ecstatic moment, this morning are reaching for the Bengay. And those celebrating fans missed worship and are taking aspirin. Because you see, as really wonderful as that ecstasy is, as that moment of pure joy is, it fades. But if you've ever held a child, if you've ever loved a woman or a man, if you've ever been able to touch and heal someone in need, if you've had a moment of love, you've had the experience of God. And it keeps getting richer. The mystery is beyond us, but the experience is as close as the person at your side.